Hi there, and welcome to Everyday Business with me, Aidan Donnelly. This week's episode is a little different. We recently had a live event where I interviewed Bobby Healy of Mana Drone and Meili fame, among many other ventures. This is the recording of our chat. Hope you enjoy it. Good evening, everybody, and you're very welcome to Davy House this evening. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Aidan Donnelly. I'm head of equities for Davy, and I've been analysing and investing in companies for nearly 30 years, and I'm always fascinated by how companies operate and the entrepreneurs that start them and the business people that, and managements that run them. And this is a shameless plug bit, because earlier this year we actually launched a podcast called Everyday Business with Aidan Donnelly, and in that I interview a whole host of people with different stories and backgrounds and journeys, and trying to learn about their business and gleaning some of their insights from that experience. So it is my great pleasure to introduce Bobby Healy. Bobby began his career as a video games, making video games for Nintendo. After that, he founded Elan, an airline tech company, which he sold to Cita, before going on to build Car Trawler over 15 years and led two successful LBOs of that business. For the last 4 years, he's been building Mana Drone Delivery, a business whose mission is to improve the world by making lightning-fast suburban deliveries affordable, green and safe. Nice, easy statement to get through, that one. He's also the founder of Meili Travel Technology, with a mission to end the fiasco of car hire broking. So aside from that, though, Bobby is also very keen, interested in philanthropy, and is an active member of the board of Deborah Ireland, as well as running several fundraising events. So, Bobby, you're very welcome this evening.
Thanks for having me.
We'll get down to a nice, easy question to start off with, okay? And we're obviously talking about entrepreneurship. And when you think about the role of an entrepreneur, they've got to develop a product or service, they've got to raise capital, they've got to manage the business, got to build the business, right? Can one person be good at all of those things?
Jesus, that's a very tough question to start off with. Yes, I think so. Okay. I mean, I have a lot of gaps, but that's none of those are my gaps. Sorry, does that sound big-headed? Yeah. I'm very big-headed. Well, my mother raised me. I think you can have a lot of. I mean, like, I'm 35 years running businesses, building tech. So if I haven't learned most of those things at this stage.
But for an entrepreneur on their own, starting off, do you think they need to surround themselves by people maybe where their skill set, where they don't have the skill set?
For sure. I mean, I do. I mean, I've always been, I think, quite good and forward thinking in the people I bring around me to help me run businesses. And I definitely have huge gaps when you think about scaling a business or even running a medium-sized business. There's a big diversity of skills that, I mean, not everyone has. And certainly my skill set, ironically, being in Davies, I'm not a good financial person. That makes any sense. I always need a strong CFO to clean up after me. But obviously on tech and strategy and fundraising, which I think are the important parts for what I'm building now, are my strong suits. And when I won't say when I hire people, because I always think hiring is a very transactional sounding thing. Most of the people that work with me now, I've known them for quite some time. They're in my network one way or the other. And there's people that I've spent years trying to hire. And I have people work for me now that have worked for me for 25 years in three different businesses. So you're the people that come with you and the things that they do, it's the sum of you all, I think, that are running the business. And I don't like going out to hire someone for a critical skill without knowing them. You know, I always feel that if you're going out to a headhunter with a role that you've failed in your job or running a business, you should already know the bulk of the people you need to hire well in advance, and you should be working on it through your network and through meeting them, getting to know them and so on well in advance. But I think, I think I've done a good job, not a supreme job, but a good job of finding where my gaps are and filling them in with good people. And I think Mana is well stocked Mailey is the other business, the travel technology business that I have, which is a competitor for Car Trawler, fun fact. That's well stocked as well, mostly with Car Trawler people. But that's the point, right? It's about, you know, knowing a business is a jigsaw, right? Full of people that, you know, complete a jigsaw of different skill sets, of, you know, different levels of pace that they can do, you know, operations people versus strategy people and so on. And I work, I think, very hard at that part of the business, harder than a lot of people I would know, actually, the amount of time I spend just meeting people for no particular reason. And everyone I'm meeting, it's an interview, they just don't know it. Honestly, it is. It's almost like stalker level stuff. The notes I take on meetings I have with people at some point in the future, we can continue the conversation. Yeah, it's a very active part of the time I spend.
When you think about being an entrepreneur, and I've often asked a good few people about this, you know, is it a case that, you know, which comes first? Are you an entrepreneur and then try and find a business, or do you find a product or service gap and say, I have a solution for that, and then a business develops out of it?
I've seen both.
Yeah. Which you think is more successful?
And if it's like left or right wing, it's kind of the people that are always looking for ideas and then, you know, go for that maybe are already in the business, they're already, you know, established, and then they think they want to do something startup-y, versus the airheads that are permanently out there in the fringes coming up with crazy ideas but with no skills whatsoever, and then they have to bring in tech people. You couldn't believe the amount of people I get calling me saying, Bobby, I've got this unbelievable idea, I just need an app built, you know, could you get me a tech guy? It's like, for fuck's sake, that's all I ever do. Is like, you've started in the wrong place, just stop now. If you don't have tech DNA, it's very difficult, I think, to build.
Have a tech company.
Yes, I think so. But a lot of people try it. And I think that's a bad recipe. But I think there are plenty of instances where both work, you know, but I think it requires a really smart, business-minded person to make it work if they're not tech, whereas a mediocre tech guy can make it work, like me. I think it's harder if you're not tech.
What have you learned from being a serial entrepreneur? Do you know, as you move through each different thing and each iteration, you know, do you actually remember stuff and actually apply learnings the next time around?
I think I'm a little bit better now than I was when I was, you know, 18 building my first company, but not much better. You don't get smarter over life, you learn more things. Am I a better... Yeah, I'm better now for sure running a company. I've probably learned some things that make it less of a risk. But the biggest thing I learned, like I would say, there's only one thing I learned, I think, that made a material impact on my, you know, chance of success was people engagement. And I learned that early in my second business in Eland, which I started in Mexico City. And my partner in that business was an old guy, really old guy. He was 51. I remember the time, you know, thinking, Jesus Christ, what do I have in common with
You've
this guy?
It's like, what majority of this what room, I, I'm just going to tell
I know,
you
now. Yeah, what will I even say to this person? But he told me a lot about the human side of building a business, and also the human side of the guy on the other side of the counter when you're doing a deal. And I think that had the biggest positive impact on me running businesses. And after that, like I still don't think of myself as an entrepreneur. I think of myself as just a very unstructured, chaotic risk taker that enjoys doing what he's doing. Like I really have, I mean, obviously Mana, I absolutely love it. It's the first business I've lost sleep with, and it's the hardest I've ever worked, but I just absolutely love it. Whereas Mailey is almost boring. I'm not an operational role there. I founded it with Mike and, you know, help him with some strategy stuff. And it bores me, you know, but it's still a fantastic business, right? So I don't consider myself an entrepreneur. I consider myself an opportunist that is lucky enough that the opportunities are good crack.
You mentioned you started the first business when you were 18. Is youth or naivety an advantage when you're starting a business?
Well, I'm 54 now. I started Man when I was 49. So do you think that it's a smart idea to start a drone delivery business in Ireland where there's no capital, there's no regulation, the weather's awful and nobody wants it and nobody believes in it? Yeah. I mean, I think naivety is part of your DNA. The whole way through.
What age you are.
Yeah, I think so. And so youth doesn't come into it. I think if you're, I won't say a dreamer, but I think if you enjoy really difficult but interesting learning experiences with great teams of people, and I think you have to be a why not person versus a why person, that's for sure. But I don't call that naivety because I'm technical too, so I can pretty quickly assess whether or not it's technically
not
feasible. Yeah, at least I can tell if it's technically viable, and the business side of it, that's easy to see through to as well. And I did spend a lot of time before any real investment happened in Manna assessing it to see if it would be viable. So like I didn't jump into it naively, but I'm still to this day, 5 years later, finding most people still don't believe it's possible or viable, which is a good place to be because it means,
that you won't get competition.
Competition's not coming anytime soon. Yeah. And well, it will. The competition is going to be quite a lot soon. But back to your question, does 18-year-old me, no, I mean, I was naive from, you know, cash flow and basics of running the business. We ran out of cash after a year. So not naive, just dumb.
The you know, when you look at your experience with Incartrawler and you look at Manna and you look at the other startups, which is harder, a startup or a scale-up?
Scale-up's harder because scale-up has the most difficult problem in it, which is people. Okay. And people are an exponentially difficult thing to scale.
Even when you can have decent control over who you bring in?
Yeah, but you don't, though, because once you get past your first 150, you're not hiring them anymore. And you're not, you know, you don't know their names. You're not meeting them regularly. You're down now to broadcast management where you're doing town halls or you're trying to, you know, you're doing all this, what I would call corporate stuff, which is around structured process and performance management and OKRs and all these good ways to manage businesses, but it's incredibly difficult. And then you have all this Machiavellian stuff that goes on and large numbers of people where most of them are rowing in the wrong direction intentionally. And it gets very political very quick. And I don't like that. I don't enjoy that part of running a business. And it's the hardest part. So by far the hardest thing is not getting a business to escape velocity, you know, profitability and, you know, the product built and accepted and starting to grow. It's the next 10 years where you're really high growth and you're outgrowing a lot of the people and you have to bring in people that you don't know as well and they may have different motivations or different culture or DNA to the rest of the team. And then you IPO, hopefully, you know, that's certainly, for the type of business we're building now, it's certainly an IPO candidate if we get, you know, successful enough. That world as well, right? So, no, the easiest part is the first handful of years.
And when you think about the whole people question, do you think, you know, as you sit as a manager, particularly if a larger company would say, do you prefer to train up or parachute in people?
You train up.
Train up.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. It's something we did very well in Incartrawler. We brought people from the call center. We had 600 people, 200 of them were in the call center. And I would say of the 600, probably, I don't know, rough numbers, a third of them had come from the call center and gotten into really important jobs in the company with no formal training or education in that space. And we trained them because they were culturally very well aligned with the business. They believed in it. They were part of the Thursday night parties. They deserved the chance, firstly. And they were blank slates with the right attitude and, to a lesser extent, the right aptitude. But I'll take aptitude all day long over attitude, sorry, all day long over aptitude. Mm-hmm. And you can help people and you can find the right place for them, but they'll work for you forever. Mm-hmm. And they'll be loyal, and that's what company needs. It doesn't need churn of, you know, people with great CVs that have done it before, sure, in inverted commas, but you don't know what they've really done before, because if they come from a big company, it doesn't mean anything, you know?
You mentioned the area of culture, and again, when you think about, you know, the culture, is it easier to get the culture right in a startup because you have a clean slate, or when you go in and scale up, you're kind of cleaning up other people's messes to a certain, in the initial stage anyway?
Yeah, I have so much experience in getting that right and getting it wrong, and I couldn't tell you what I did different any of the times. That's for me. I have very little advice. I always tell people not to listen to advice from people like me. But that's one area I think that's a really interesting part of my life. And the example is Manna and Maley, and to another extent, Cartrawler. You know, we grew Cartrawler until myself and Mike exited. The culture hadn't changed. It was the same. It was great culture, good fun, really hard working people, and with, you know, it was clean, I would say, clean, good culture. And Maley now is 35 people. A lot of them know each other, a lot of them don't. But it's such a happy place. I mean, they have a great time. They're all relaxed. Feels like they're not even working. And the business is really doing well. They signed 8 airlines. It's probably going to be EBITDA positive next year. I wouldn't be surprised. So it's unbelievably good and happy bunch of people. And yet Manna is absolute chaos. Everyone is stressed beyond belief. And I don't think it's a negative culture, but it's a culture of real, heavy, hard, stressful startup. And I don't think there's any other way to achieve what we're doing in Manna other than that, because we're milestone driven, and it's existential milestones. If you don't get there, you can't fundraise. Right? We have to achieve these things, and you can't move, you can't delay. Like, shipping a product late is one thing. If we're late, we've no story to sell. We can't raise a round. Or if we do, it's going to be on, you know,
not so attractive terms.
So we have the constant existential problem in Manna of cash. And we burn a fair chunk of cash. Like, we've raised $43 million so far. We're going to fundraise again pretty soon. It's a capital intensive business, and the milestones we have are next level difficult milestones to achieve. A lot of them are in our control, so they're engineering, product, and, you know, software and hardware and things like that. But some of them are not in our control, like regulatory and market and certain commercial ones. There's a lot of moving parts. So, I mean, we've, I think, 105 people in Manna, and every one of them is under a huge amount of pressure. It's not a place for the weak-hearted or people that think they're going to have any quality of life.
And if you look at that, certain people need not apply, just in case. You heard it here. If you see that job,
but that's, but the point. But the point of it is, those are two companies that I am deeply involved in. And it's two different outcomes, and neither of them are right or wrong. It's just what's
they
required.
They are what they are.
Yeah. Well, can we clean up Manna? Yes. When we reach escape velocity and we're a normal business, we're scaling and growing, and capital is not a question, then we'll try and, you know, celebrate people's birthdays and, you know.
And how far on that journey on the milestones in Manna are you?
I'd say another 2 years will be... it'll be a hard 2 years. The next 2 years will be very hard, harder than the last 5, I think. But if we get there, then I think we'll be in a very good place where we'll be two businesses. We'll be an R&D, an engineering, manufacturing business, and we'll be a growth scaling business across markets. And that one will be a nice business, and the other one will be, you know, an aircraft manufacturing business. Probably two totally different businesses.
The, you know, when you look at what the staff are going through in both places, right, and it's probably an easier situation to think about this in, from the Manna perspective, albeit, you know, but there's that idea, if you want somebody to act like an owner of a business, you have to make them an owner of a business, right? And particularly those people in Manna who are basically getting their heads slammed against the wall day in, day out.
Yeah, and underpaid.
And underpaid. Yeah. Do they have to then, is that the natural part where ownership comes in, that you've got to have that carrot?
I think so. Well, first of all, I think it's the right thing to do. Mm-hmm. You know, sharing the equity with the team is, if you're asking them, it's not even if you're asking them to sacrifice and work extra hard. I just think, you know, we're all in a high-risk venture together. Everyone should share the upside. I've always believed in that. Same with Mike and in Maley. So there's no question there. And I think we've allocated a very substantial amount of equity to the founding team, and to every employee in the company has some level of equity. Does it change how hard they work? Not really. It changes whether they stay or not, but not like on a vesting. They're not looking at their vesting schedule and saying, okay, I'm going to go, you know, in December because there's no more. They just think it's recognition of the pain. They don't work any harder. They couldn't. And it allows us to make the business more efficient with cash by not, you know, constantly having to increase salaries or pay to keep them from going to Meta or Google, because we're constantly getting poaching from the FDI companies, particularly where they're offering, you know, not far off double the salaries that we're paying, and we're still able to keep the people. And you do that with kind of shared belief in what we're building, a real belief that what we're building is going to be absolutely gigantic. And people will be afraid.
Everybody has a clarity of purpose in that.
Oh, yeah.
They all buy into it and they all believe it.
I think so, yeah. Mm-hmm. And pretty obvious the ones that don't. We don't fire many people. A lot of people leave. Not a lot of people, but the churn we get is people leaving because they just, it's too much for them.
Mm-hmm. The when you look at, I suppose, car trawlers is the better example rather than these two. But I suppose when the Maley and the Manna one, as a company gets bigger, particularly a tech company gets bigger, do you think the level of innovation falls? Is that the big risk?
It can do. Yeah. It's difficult to... some companies you have the benefit of, instead of the stack going up, it goes sideways. So you can just add different products horizontally, and you can compartmentalize those and treat them individually, and you can keep doing that, and that works well. Stripe would be an example of that, Google to an extent as well. But for us, it's one product. It is an aircraft. Mm-hmm. And the goal will be to try and keep the team as small as possible for exactly the reason you said, because, I mean, you know, Boeing build an aircraft with, you know, about 50,000 people. I can't imagine how difficult it is to synchronize something like that. Now, obviously, it's a much more complex product, but it's vertical, right? It's one aircraft. So what we should do is be very disciplined about the product so that we don't build bells and whistles or things that might be exciting to talk about. We're building an ugly aircraft with limited capabilities.
Functional.
That's safe. Mm-hmm. That's it. Our product is actually a safe mule, and that's all we're building. So it's, and clarity on that, so that we don't need a lot of innovation. We need discipline. We need clarity on exactly what we're building. And that's a nice luxury we have in Manna, because we do know exactly what we need to build. We're not evolving a product with customers and blah, blah, blah. And Cartrawler was different than that. Cartrawler was much more complex because we had, you know, probably 150 very large customers that all wanted something different, and you had a product team, and you had a... That's really hard to scale, very, very hard to scale. So, you know, engineering follows the law of diminishing returns in spectacular fashion. The moment you go over five or six people, there's very little return you get on seven. And I'm an engineer of software. Software is acutely in that category. Yeah. In the aircraft, we have 10, 11 different subsystems. You have propulsion, you have avionics, you have, you know, mission control, onboard mission control, flight control, you have airframe, and you have body shell and power, right? Those are the main air components. They're all separate, almost completely independent units.
Engineering disciplines.
Yeah. Yeah. And they don't even hardly need to talk to each other. Not that they would anyway, because they're all engineers. But it's nice. Yeah. It's nice. We have some nice tailwinds, and that's one of them.
Yeah. What percentage of your success is due to luck, and what's down to hard work?
You ride your luck hard. Okay. I've definitely had a lot of luck, mostly serendipity of meeting people. The business before Cartrawler was the best example of that. Eland, you know, we were doing great, but we were going to go bust because our biggest customer hadn't pulled the plug. They just didn't pay us. It was Mexico, after all.
What a surprise.
And we were going to go bust. And then I bumped into this guy, American guy, Dan Conroy, who's head of travel for American Express Latin America. And I just bumped into him through an acquaintance. We had dinner and I got a $25 million contract a little bit after that. But that made me, you know, or at least made the first part of my journey, because Elan became a very successful business and I sold it. And then I was in a position where I could choose what to do next rather than take something quickly.
Yeah.
And that was pure luck. And Cartrawler the same. I was introduced to Greg and Niall Turley. You know, they had this, you know, car rental business and it had nothing in it. But that marriage of me and them was just absolutely perfect and pure chance. So it's those things, right, that I think I've been lucky with. I've had more than my fair share of luck, but you can't ignore the requirement of hard work as well, right? But hard work on its own doesn't get you there. I mean, it's a good
thing. It's like they say, the harder I work, the luckier I get, you know?
Yeah, I believe that, of course. Yeah, I mean, if you create enough, if you're at the roulette wheel enough times, you know, it's going to land on your number, and that's the equivalent of work and find the right opportunity. But, yeah.
To what extent has fear of failure been a driving force for Bobby Heenan?
Never been. No. Almost looking for things that are so high risk that, you know, I might eventually fail. No. Like, I don't fear the failure, no. You know, I think the people that fear failure are just doing so because of their financial positions rather than, you know, egos or anything like that. And there's genuine, rational fear there. And as I said earlier on, I got lucky early, and so I haven't really ever had that fear. No, and I don't fear, like, you build a business, it's a decade, right? You're given, say, okay, I'm going to start a new business. You're committing yourself for a decade. So there's not a lot of decades that you can, you know, use, right? So you don't want to fail for that reason, maybe, right?
Yeah.
But, like, even if Mana folded spectacularly in a few years' time, which I think is quite unlikely now, I'd be quite proud of it, and I won't celebrate the failure, but I'd be very happy to talk about it and explain it and see where did it all go wrong and all that stuff. And I wouldn't regret one minute of it. I'm certain of that.
We talked about capital raising and things like that, but how important is it that your capital investors are aligned with you and your goals for the business?
Yeah. Well, that hasn't happened yet with Mana. For me, the answer, what does that mean to me, is when do we exit? How far do we want to go? Do I want to sell it early, take the cash, or do I want to, you know, really go for it? And when you're in venture capital, you have to be in agreement that you're the company that returns the fund, or 10X is the fund, or whatever it is. And you have to be honest with them about it, because otherwise, no good venture fund wants a 3X return on their portfolio company. They want a 1,000X. They want you to be that person. And so at least the ones that I want to partner with as well, I'm looking for that too. I want to run Mana as an all or nothing game. And so there's not many, I would say, good venture capitalists that wouldn't be in that same boat.
Right.
It's the model. So PE isn't exactly going to be enamored with, you know, that. And outside of that, you know, like, what do you need from venture capital? You need money. You need them to find you more money, and potentially to, you know, act as a sounding board for certain decisions that you want to make. Mm-hmm. But a funny thing about investors is most of them haven't run businesses.
Yeah.
Right. So, you want them to find money for you.
And then I suppose in that end, how do you manage them when things aren't going well? Is it out front and be honest straight away?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what boards are for. You know, you're honest that you're bored, hopefully. And so far, anyway, we haven't had any bad news. When the bad news comes, that's when you see who people are. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, we raised the bridge round end of last year. And that was where we were saying, okay, look, we haven't done enough yet to raise a proper equity round. Let's do that. And we had very strong support from our investors. So I think that's a good sign. Going bad for us, for me, would be mismanagement of the business. It wouldn't be things that were unexpected that happened that would be bad news, but, you know, that's, you know, whatever.
It's the nature of the risk.
That's the nature of it, exactly. Or the conversation not going as well as we thought with the European regulator or the American regulator, whatever. That's like, and we have bad news like that all the time, but that's bad news that you manage around. But for me, what I'd be disappointed with myself would be is if I just mismanaged, didn't execute well, you know, or fail to make tough decisions or whatever. But so far, anyway, I think we're doing pretty well.
Obviously, you've had exits all along the way, and of different types of exits, but exits nonetheless. How do you know when it's the right time to leave and to exit where you are and move on to the next journey?
For Eland, it was easy because my 51-year-old friend had become 60-something, and he was risk-averse, and this was his only gig. And so that was easy. And then I said, do I want to do this on my own? I didn't. So that was an easy decision. We had a buyer anyway, an inbound buyer. It's like, okay, just move on. For Car Trawler, it was also pretty straightforward. We had different, you know, shareholders in the business, the founders, me and Mike. And it was, you know, me and Mike were taking the business forward. The founders were going to be exiting or partially exiting, whatever. We were aligned, you know, I would say very well aligned. And PE were always knocking on our door, so were trade. So it was like lots of opportunity. There was nothing to think about then. And I think when you go into it, certainly when I go into Mana and when I go into Maley, we know at the start what we want the outcome to be. For Maley, we want it to be a big smash, EBITDA positive, business sold to trade reasonably quickly, you know, and potentially do some acquisitions along the way, but a relatively short and relatively unambitious type of, I'd say, capital event. Unambitious maybe is an unfair word on it. It'll be a very successful one, but it's not taking over the world in the same way as Mana. And Mana is 100%, we are going to keep going here until
we're stopped. You're swinging for the features on this one.
Yeah, we are. And everyone's in there now. That'll change when we start. We do our B round, our C round, we start generating cash and things like that. People will want to take a few quid off the table, and that's fine. But I definitely, even though I'm probably not a public market CEO, as you can probably hear when I'm talking, I would like to get it that far, whatever that entails. And so I definitely don't want to, I want to really go for this. And so far anyway, we are, that I know of, the best shot in the world of getting there. And the team are on board with that as well. And so far, we've been lucky enough, we're doing very well. So the motivation is really high, morale is very high, and we all, mostly anyway, we believe we're going to pull it off. So there isn't really any, no one's saying, when are we going to sell, when are we going to sell, when are we going to sell? Whereas I do know some companies, that's all the employees are saying, when are we going to sell, when are we going to sell? And that's not a great place to be.
Switching tacks a little bit to the philanthropy side of it. Why is it so important for you to give something back?
I don't know. I've four children. Did that change me? Don't know. No, I think I have a reasonably good, you know, ethical view of things. I think it's obvious that everyone wants to, or most people want to do something outside of just working and making money. And for me, I was donating to charities. I mean, a lot of people do, and I would as well, very invisibly and not really making it. And at the time, I remember before I met Jimmy Fearon, who's the CEO of Debra, you know, I found it unusually difficult to find a charity to donate to, like to get to look through it to see, you know, what's really
happening with my euro that I
not that I hate to call it ROI, but it's kind of what's the impact here. I want to make sure that I'm not, you know, just letting someone waste the money and not having I wanted to find something that I thought was well run, efficiently run, and there's a direct impact. And and then I thought, and then also, look, you know, I'm not an all-round brilliant business guy or anything, but charities need some help. You know, generally speaking, the charities are run by very good people that love the charity and are passionate about it, but they could use a bit of help on the commercial side, right? And Tom, I think, would agree with this. The reason myself and Tom got involved is we felt that we could not just, you know, get, you know, help with fundraising, mm-hmm. which we do, but we could also potentially, I sit on the board of Deborah, I've been on the board for a long time now. I felt that I could potentially help them steering certain things, and I think I have.
It's time, network, skills, advice, yeah. It's all of that.
Yeah.
It's probably ultimately more valuable to them in terms of the longer term success of the charity.
Yeah, correct. Like in the end, you know, as ugly as it is to say, it's truthful to say that a charity ultimately is a business that's selling a product. Yeah. As horrible as that sounds. And they need work developing it, marketing it. They need understanding how do you scale certain processes. And it's a sales process as well. Fundraising for charity is a sales process. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of very common themes in a charity that there are in a business. And so it's important, I think, that a charity has some commercial DNA in it. And that's what I thought that'd be useful to add and to do that. And then on the fundraising as well, I'm not as effective as that because it takes a lot of time, but I do help them with fundraising.
I heard the bashers in the house are great.
Yeah, you should try and get an invite.
I know a fellow who might give me one the next time, you know.
They are great, and they raise a few quid, but you'd be surprised at the things that are effective, really effective at fundraising. Yeah. And it is about network and influencing people like everyone that's in this room. Everyone here has a great network, and it's not about directly getting checks off people. It's about getting them just to help a bit, you know. And it takes a lot of time, and I think Tom would say that too. It's an investment of time, arguably, that I don't have. But I do think that it's not... Some people say there's charity washing too. So look at me, I do some charity stuff. I do give a fair bit of time, and it's time I don't have. But I think it's the right thing to do, I think.
Bobby, we can obviously see you're really high energy. What about work-life balance?
I have 4 kids. And I have a wife that raises them. And I spend as much time as I can. I work from home a lot, so that's very rewarding for me. But in my office, there's nothing much more outside of work for me. And there hasn't been for a long time. That's the truth. I'm not very proud of that, but I do my best. And the second part on the energy levels, it is true that I have less energy than I had when I was, whatever, 20 and 30. That's noticeably, for me anyway, I have less time. I used to work till 4 in the morning, 5 in the morning, whatever, all the time. Now I need the odd snooze every now and then, but I'm definitely, as you said, more energetic than most people around me. And how do they deal with that? You know, I recognize that, and I don't expect everyone to be like me. It's impossible. There are plenty of people like me, though, and some even worse than I am. But I can't expect everyone to be at that work rate. And I, bizarrely, I do the opposite. Don't do what I do. Don't follow my lead here. Have a life, exercise, take time off. Make sure you take your holidays. I force people to take their holidays. I make the people who work for me do exactly the opposite of what I do. I don't know. It's just I'm not going to change from that. And that's going to be a problem because, you know, I could have retired before, you know, I could have taken a rest before, but it's a terrible thing to say, but don't know what I would do with all the time. You know, learn how to garden maybe, or back to my footballing career.
My wife might kill you.
You know, just to be clear, I love what I'm doing now and it works well at home. I mean, everyone's happy enough. And some people in work, maybe they're a bit fearful of that, but you know, I think I recognize that there's different things for different people. Good question. I've never been asked that before.
Right, those of you who listen to the podcast will know I have a closing tradition on it, and that is the question in the black book. I do not know what the question is. My last guest on the podcast wrote the question in there, didn't know who it was going to. I know who wrote the question. Bobby doesn't know who wrote the question and doesn't know what the question is, and I don't know what the question. I'm going to open it up. So far, I've been lucky that the question has always suited the person I've asked. So keep your fingers crossed or else this is going to fall flat in its face very badly. So here we go. All right. I've lucked out yet again. Bobby, Entrepreneurs, nature or nurture?
Nature.
Simple as.
Yeah, that's an easy one. Nature. You'd struggle to find an entrepreneur that learned it somehow. No, I think you're it's part of you.
You're hardwired. You are.
I think so, yeah. Yeah. A risk taker, you know. Yeah.
That was an easy one.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, yeah.
I thought we were going to get really deep, that's a very easy one here, you know. About psychology.
That's a real point. Who asked that question? That's really.
Oh, I can't tell you.
You can't tell. Okay. My question won't be so easy to answer.
Well, I'll let you know who tells your question. But anyway, I'd like to thank you, Bobby, for joining us tonight, and thank you all for coming along. Again, another shameless plug for Everyday Business with Aidan Donnelly. If you enjoy what you hear, like, share and subscribe. It's on all of the platforms. Well, thanks very much, and we'll see you soon. Well, that's it for this week's episode. I hope you enjoyed the chat with Bobby, and remember to like, share and subscribe if you did.
The participants in this podcast have done so for the purpose of sharing their own individual business experiences. Some are clients of Davey and some are not. They have not received a gratuity or other payment for their time in making the podcast. The views expressed throughout are their own. Warning: the information in this podcast is not a recommendation or investment research. It does not purport to be financial advice. You should speak to your advisor in the context of your own personal circumstances prior to making any financial or investment decision. In the Republic of Ireland, J&E Davy Unlimited Company, trading as Davy and Davy Private Clients, is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. Davy is a Davy Group company and also a member of the Bank of Ireland Group. In the United Kingdom, Davy Private Clients UK, Davy UK and Davy Capital Markets UK are the trading names of J&E Davy UK Limited. J&E Davy UK Limited is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. J&E Davy UK Limited is a Davy Group company and also a member of the Bank of Ireland Group.